Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Williams, a veteran UN correspondent, journalist, author, and senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. He writes for Tribune, Salon, Alternet, and Maxim's News, among many others, and is the author of a number of books, including The UN for Beginner, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. He blogs at Deadline Pundit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Williams.
Great to be back, Ian Masters.
And today, the Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon, in releasing the UN report on the rocket attack in the Syrian capital of Damascus on August 21st, says, first of all, that sarin was used, and he says this is a war crime. And then just in terms of news in that region, Turkey said it shot down a Syrian helicopter on its border. So just dealing with the UN report, since you've covered the UN for so long, is this going to resonate, do you think? I mean, or they just don't want to upset the Russian-American deal? Not that that's that solid at any rate.
Well, it was going to resonate, and it offers those who want something to be done, if what they're suggesting to be done is feasible and effective, a great weapon. Although, as far as we know, Russian insistence, this report doesn't name names. It points out it was surface-to-surface missiles that were used, and that the weaponry was all marked in Cyrillic. So we all know who is supplying the government side. And, of course, it's Western imperialism is supplying the rebels. So these are liberating socialist Russian missiles that were delivering sarin into the masses of Damascus. It's fairly clear. And I think it shows as well that, first of all, there are limits to the Russian conscience. They know that this is intolerable in the court of public opinion in the world. They also know that the temptation for the Americans to actually do something, for the West to do something, would become overwhelming and with reasonable excuse. So they've really managed this almost a sort of jujitsu move. They've used the strength against itself, because whereas 2 or 3 weeks ago we were talking about responsibility to protect and the need to protect civilians, since this chemical weapons attack, first of all, Obama was talking about a punishment. You know, this is Israeli-style vindictiveness. Punishing the Syrian regime does nothing to help the Syrian people. And the chances are a lot of Syrian people would be in the way of whatever punishment strikes that went. He sounded like Netanyahu and the retaliatory strikes that Israel practices. But the other part is that the Russians actually have influence with Damascus. They've forced them to offer to disarm, to let the inspectors in. And I can imagine that al-Assad and his generals had their elbows very seriously twisted by the Russians. So, I mean, what we have to do now is to rally international public support on the Russians to tell al-Assad the game's up, negotiate. If they can get them to accept giving up their chemical and biological weapons and to accept inspectors, they can force them to the negotiating table. And the fact that they've been, in a sense, shamed into doing this by the behavior of their clients suggests that if the Russians were deadly serious and enough pressure were put on the Russians, that there might be a negotiated solution out of this. It might be nice to think. I personally see there's nothing wrong with regime change. I always thought that leftists and socialists and anti-imperialists believed in regime change, especially murderous regimes. You know, I don't. Nobody shouted for a negotiated settlement with General Franco or Adolf Hitler. It was unconditional surrender was the motto in those days. But, I mean, we have to do what we can with. Here we have a murderous dictator who, unfortunately, is strong and being armed. We should try to disengage his allies and force him into a negotiated position that protects the people of Syria.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Williams, who's a veteran UN correspondent, journalist, author, and senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. His books include The UN for Beginners, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. And he blogs at Deadline Pundit. So far what we've heard from the United States is from the U.S. representative of the UN, Samantha Power. She said, the Assad regime possesses sarin, and we have no evidence that the opposition possesses sarin. And it defies logic to think members of the opposition would have infiltrated a regime-controlled area to fire on opposition-controlled areas. And even though the UN report, the 41-page report that came out today, does not assign blame, it does say that the delivery vehicles delivering quite a substantial quantity of sarin were a variant of the M14 artillery rocket, a Russian-made and supplied rocket, which you mentioned the Cyrillic lettering on this rocket is also included in the report. It also talks about the coordinates and the trajectories of where these rockets were fired and where they landed, and they came from the northwest, and those trajectories are clearly in the Assad military's lines. So
it's quite clear that the Assad regime is guilty. I mean, you don't know what is more scary, the fact that al-Assad might have condoned or ordered these strikes, or that he's lost control of his military and that they're behaving like local vindictive warlords doing their own version of Sabra and Shatila in Damascus.
Well, there was an intercept that suggested that somebody, there's a commander in the 155th Brigade talking to the Unit 450, the ones that control the chemical weapons, and the conversation was like the general in charge was talking to the local commander saying, you did what? So there's a possibility that this was an unauthorized use, but on the other hand, if this guy's a dictator for life, he's the son of a dictator. They say that this is their private plantation. They have a divine right to rule. So they have to take responsibility for their country, surely.
The conventions, unless they can show that they're taking steps to discipline, very effectively discipline the people who carried out this, then they are equally guilty on the chain of command. Although I have to say that the United States, over and over again in recent wars, has not practiced the same discipline. It has overlooked what its troops have done without punishing them, as we know.
You mean like the Mille massacre, and although they did eventually...
Well, the Mille massacre, some sort of there were raps on the knuckles.
I'm right.
Example of the WikiLeaks pictures of the helicopter strike on the Reuters correspondent in Baghdad, in which the Pentagon, first of all, claimed that the video they couldn't find the video. And since then, I believe there's been no investigation whatsoever into the people who killed the journalists and the civilians who came to the aid of the wounded afterwards, all of which are indisputably war crimes in the same way.
Sure. Well, nobody ever said that the U.S. history of intervention was a very pretty one. And clearly, the American people, are undergoing a sea change here. There's this combination of sort of right-wing isolation and left-wing isolation going on in the United States, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes, but the left-wing isolation is different. The right-wing tends to be genuine isolation. They really don't give a damn about the fate of Syrian civilians or any others. This is, in the words of Chamberlain, a faraway country of which we know little. They don't want to get in the quarrel. But the left is very eager to get into everybody's quarrels and shout for solidarity and support. And, you know, here are civilians being massacred by a murderous, brutal regime. And they are, if not quite applauding, they're saying nothing should be done. And, you know, I'm sorry. The question isn't whether to intervene or not to intervene. There should have been intervention. There should be intervention. The question is, who intervenes and how and what form? And I would tend to agree that the United States are the least well-equipped in terms of, morality, reputation, and even, methodology in a way that doesn't cause more harm. And that's the real conundrum. But, you know, it really is to stand up there and chant no intervention is very much like the sort of two legs good, four legs bad, or the reverse in Animal Farm. But the point is there should have been intervention, there should be international intervention. And I quite agree that the United States are not the people to do that intervention. Certainly not military intervention, and certainly not a vindictive, punitive strike that has no clear end result. And by the way, I really see no problems with regime change. The whole point, if you have a murderer for a regime, then you change the regime. And the international community should do it, but it should do it under close supervision and under close eye. And the US has shown that it's not prepared to accept those type of restraints. On each occasion, it's practiced it.
Well, those apologists for the Assad regime basically say that the problem is with the other side, with the jihadists, the Salafists, the al-Nusra Front, and the people that the Saudis let in, the heart eaters, as they often referred to, and as Putin referred to them as a couple of times, and so did Assad. So that seems to be the main argument that I hear against intervention, is that the other side, the revolution, are worse than Assad.
Well, that's a broad brushstroke. First of all, it's quite true that the Salafists are pretty evil people. They moved into the vacuum created by the abstention of the world that left the opposition swing in the wind. Certainly the US should exercise its full power with the Saudis in the Gulf and tell them, you keep these people out or there will be serious consequences. And it can do, we know that. If it wanted to. But, I mean, the real issue was that that Washington didn't have a dog in this fight, as James Baker famously said about the Balkans. There was a lot of indecision about Syria. And that, you know, he's a bogeyman, but he was a relatively secular regime. And in terms of one of the big sort of no-nos of American politics, yes, he posed a threat, quote, to Israel, but he never exercised that threat. There wasn't a single incursion or attack from Syria into Israel for 30 years, 40 years, from 1973 to 2013. So, you know, he was a stabilizing influence as far as the Israelis were concerned. They could live with him. They didn't mind him killing his own people. Save them the job.
Well, given that this report's come out and it's pretty clear that even though they don't name names, that the UN report attributes this attack on the regime because of the trajectories and the coordinates and the ordnance being these M-14 Russian missiles and the fact that the regime possesses sarin and they've determined that sarin was used. And as we said in the beginning, Ian Williams, it's unlikely that the U.S. is going to make a fuss over it, even though Samantha Power has condemned it. I don't imagine they want to scuttle this deal that they've just made with Russia. And if you try to refer this to the International Criminal Court, it would be blocked by Russia in the U.N. Security Council. What about the going to the General Assembly, if people actually care that a weapon of mass destruction is being used against civilian population?
Well, the only way to do that for an issue that's under consideration from the Security Council is if it's actually taken there and it's vetoed, and then the U.S. could go to an emergency special General Assembly under the terms of the Uniting for Peace resolution. But once again, U.S. diplomacy has tripped itself up because this procedure, which was pioneered by the U.S. and the West to carry on fighting the Korean War in the teeth of the Russian veto, back in the 50s, was picked up by the Palestinians and used to bypass the American veto. So U.S. diplomacy did a 180-degree turn and has been telling everybody that the General Assembly has no power to do this and that the Special General Assembly can't do this. So it's been denigrating this. Now, if they were to do this eminently reasonable thing, it would really put the Russians in a spot, because you would have a world public forum, which if the U.S. and the West and the Arab League and the others exercised their sort of collective diplomatic efforts, would produce a resolution perhaps calling for an arms embargo, for example. Russia would find it very, very difficult to defy an expression of world public opinion like that. But the U.S. can't do that because just as Russia is defending its client state Syria, Israel is the client state of the United States and has been assiduously defended by Washington. So there hasn't been a single resolution about Israel that hasn't been vetoed by the U.S. for, 30 years?
So they don't want to take it to the General Assembly because it could set a precedent that would hurt Israel. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, precisely. I mean, the precedent's already been set.
By the Palestinians, so, right, yeah.
Yes, this would validate a procedure which they've been delegitimizing for all of these years.
Mm-hmm. So what then do you think, Ian Williams, again a veteran UN correspondent, what will the fallout be from this UN report?
No, I think the fallout has already begun, in effect. The Russians knew what was coming. The Russians knew this report was going to point the finger at their allies, no matter how indirectly. And I totally disagree with the Russian support of the Syrian regime, but they do have a point about giving Chapter 7, that's the power to use force in any resolution, because the US and the West have consistently abused it, most notoriously over Iraq. You know, that they maintained sanctions and carried out belligerent operations against Iraq for long decades after the first Gulf War, using resolutions which obviously clearly didn't mean that. And, of course, we know famously that they claimed that the residual power of those resolutions entitled them to the second invasion, which nobody believed. So, you know, there's a huge credibility factor here. And, you know, sadly, Obama had won back some of that credibility, but has been abandoning it. His stance on this has been so contradictory. First of all, he was saying that they shouldn't wait for the inspectors. Then he was saying, you know, some amounts of power is near enough saying that action would be okay without a UN resolution. And, you know, she is right as long as all other avenues have been explored. I mean, the formula that Kofi Annan came with over Kosovo was it was illegal but moral, because there was no other way to do anything about it. This has been 2-3 years in the making, and what Obama is prepared to risk what's left of the whole structure of international law so that he can show that he's a hairy-chested primate who can throw bombs at Syria. I mean, he's talking about punitive strikes. This is not a recipe for an enduring settlement. It is a way of showing off to your domestic and Israeli public opinion you're a tough guy. And, you know, we don't need that. We don't need that. Nobody needs that.
Well, but it's not, nobody's taking it seriously, though. The threat.
Well, they were. I mean, no, I mean, and,
they were know, up until
2 weeks ago. I mean,
up until he took it to the Congress, and it was clear that he's going to lose the vote, and the Congress, for a rare occasion, was actually going to reflect the mood of the American people.
And one of the causes for this, since we're both speaking in a British accent, is that the British House of Commons thwarted Cameron, and they didn't do so necessarily on an isolationist move. They did so because they wanted to see the report, because they'd already been fooled by Blair and Bush over the second Iraq war. I mean, and then secondly, because the proposal was to go ahead without even an attempt at getting United Nations legality for this. So those were the grounds on which they were losing.
So just in closing then, Ian Williams, obviously this is a deeply cynical situation. And yesterday I talked to somebody who actually made, I thought, a very interesting point that had the U.S. not got involved in Afghanistan and left Russia in there, Russia would have had to deal with that mess that we've been dealing with for over a decade now. And it referred to it as the poison chalice, that if you win, you end up holding the bag. And he made that point about Syria, that Syria is a poison chalice, and that at the end of the day, Russia may win the victory but lose the war by being stuck with the place.
There is no good way out of this. There really isn't. I mean, it's a disaster all round for almost everyone concerned. But strong action right at the beginning might have forced a solution. But everybody stood back and hoped that it would sort of solve itself one way or the other.
Right.
You know, at the time, Hillary Clinton thought that the rebels were going to win. They were going to walk over. The Russians obviously thought that so that was the case and made sure it didn't happen. So it's and nobody, the very last people being considered by anyone here, including the people out there demonstrating against imperialist intervention, is the poor Syrian people themselves, who are suffering under a regime that's been killing them, that shot them down for protesting and asking for democracy. And now they have the regime on one side, they have the Salafist bloodthirsty knife men on the other side, and they might have American bombs bombing them to save them from a third quarter. It's not a good position.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ian Williams.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ian Williams, a veteran UN correspondent, journalist, author, and senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus. He is the author of a number of books, including The UN for Beginners, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans and His Past, and Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. And he blogs at Deadline Pundit. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the second anniversary of the start of the Occupy Wall Street movement. بعيونهم نوى النظرة رماني ثم اندحق علي نوى النظرة رماني جيت اني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي